You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a reopened fish hatchery, fewer beds in the Jackson County Jail, and what's ahead for abandoned schools. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, science, and environment reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
Okay, Roman, let's start with you. You recently went to a fish hatchery in Chiloquin, just north of Klamath Falls. What brought you there?
Yeah, so I went there because I was learning about this new building there at the fish hatchery that just recently opened. It's the main building of the hatchery, so this is, it's like very long and it's sort of one story, and it's like where all of the fish eggs are hatched and where the offices for the hatchery are, and they have a bunch of tanks full of water and stuff.
You just love fish.
Yes, I do like fish. I like to learn more about fish. It was built because the previous hatchery building there burned down in the 2020 Labor Day fires, so they have been having to work without a main building for about 5 years now while the new one gets built. So I went down there because I like fish, but also I want to learn what's new about this hatchery building and, you know, what makes hatcheries important in Oregon.
So the previous hatchery building burned down. What happened to the fire, and how have they been dealing with it since then?
Yeah, it was basically caught in the 242 fire, which burned near Chiloquin. I talked to the hatchery manager, Gail Mitchell, while I was there. She said that they weren't, you know, super concerned about the fire at the time, but they had to evacuate anyways. They got evacuation notice and, you know, figured it'd just be a short time away. What's important to know is that, you know, the hatchery staff also lived there. So while I was there, I mean, their houses are like right there at the hatchery, you know, just yards away from this main building that burned down. So, you know, they need to be available around the clock. So they evacuated. The manager at the time went back to check on the hatchery the next day and saw smoke coming from the building. It took firefighters a while to get there, and, you know, the hatchery building was already on fire, and they basically decided to save the houses rather than the hatchery. It was all wood. It was really old, so it would have been pretty impossible to put out at that point. But luckily, the houses were saved. The hatchery there is fed by a spring, so firefighters didn't, you know, need to pump any water. It was right there, and they were basically able to get back to work right away. All of the rest of the fish in the outdoor ponds all survived. But since then, they had to adjust a lot over these past 5 years. They brought in a construction trailer to do their office work. They had to, you know, ship in already hatched fish from hatcheries rather than bringing in eggs. And then this was all during COVID, so they also couldn't be in the same room together and had to wear masks, and it was really cold during the winter. And so they're really glad that they're back to normal again with this new building.
Yeah. Well, how important are hatcheries like this to Oregon?
Well, they're pretty important. There's 33 hatcheries in Oregon that are run by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Most of them raise fish for recreational and commercial fishing, and then they stock them in, you know, lakes across the state. This one in Chiloquin stocks 50 lakes all the way over to the eastern border in Oregon. And, you know, every other year here, they also stock another 50 lakes by air by dropping the fish into the lake via a helicopter. I also talked to a resort manager from Lake of the Woods, which is one of the lakes they stocked, who said it's really vital to have fish stocked in the lake. You know, otherwise the fish in there would not be as good. It's just not conducive to trout, essentially, which is what a lot of the fish they're raising here are. And part of the reason they're doing this is so that these anglers don't have to fish the wild fish, and they can just fish the ones that are raised specifically for that purpose. Most of the fish at this hatchery and others are modified before their eggs hatch to be infertile, so they don't breed with the wild fish. And they release about 1 million fish a year across all these lakes.
Wow, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I end up cutting a lot of things from stories sometimes. Are there any interesting things about the fishery that didn't make it in?
Yeah. One thing that I didn't talk about was how they actually move the fish around these ponds and tanks and get them loaded onto these trucks and helicopters to go stocked in lakes. They use a couple of machines, actually, that are built for loading vegetables.
Multi-purpose machines.
Yeah, essentially. So for the biggest fish, there's this conveyor belt that's used for potatoes, and they just, like, crowd the fish at the end of this pond, and they pick them up, and they load them onto this conveyor belt, and then it lifts them up and drops them into the truck.
Because they're only out of the water for a minute or so, probably.
Exactly, yeah. And then there was also this really big machine next to one of the ponds that Mitchell told me was designed to move tomatoes, which was really interesting. It reminded me, it's basically like this giant vacuum and it sucks them up and they crowd them all into one section of the pond. You just suck them all up and put them into the tank. It reminded me of that salmon cannon that you might have heard of that went viral a few years ago that's used at a dam to move fish to the other side. I also learned about how it's kind of like a giant puzzle. It's like, she called it a game of chess to figure out where and when to move the fish and the most efficient way, because sometimes they need to move them for pond cleanings or they need to get these fish in this area or these large fish. They separate out the fish into small, medium, and large, and so they don't want to put them all together. So she just has to do this giant puzzle to make sure everything is really efficient.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Roman. It sounds like you had a fun day there.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Justin, you had a story a little more serious here on reductions at the Jackson County Jail. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, not as fun as visiting a fish hatchery, but still important. So the sheriff's office is closing its jail basement. That's around 60 beds, 20% of jail capacity. So that's a significant reduction. And this comes as the jail is already at capacity a lot of the time. So the sheriff's office regularly needs to release inmates. Sheriff Nate Sickler says he expects this reduction in beds to have kind of a knock-on effect for public safety, which he's seen before. So he says that happens because, you know, people show up for court less often because they won't be put in prison if they don't show up. And people will generally realize that they won't be put in jail and there won't be as many consequences and be a bit more brazen. So especially with low-level criminals, he sees probably crime increasing there with the threat of the jail losing those beds.
Okay, well, why is the county closing part of the jail?
It comes down to cost. So Sheriff Sickler says that costs just continue to outpace revenue for law enforcement in the area. That includes labor costs, so wages to attract people to Southern Oregon, to the Rogue Valley. Inmate medical costs have also increased. An insurer that they used to use left the state recently, so they had to go with another company, and that doubled the price for inmate health care. Material costs, gas prices have increased. And what the county provides in revenue just hasn't caught up, according to the sheriff, which is an issue in sheriff's offices and a lot of other places. Reductions often happen at jails because it's thought that's better than cutting, for example, patrol or investigations. It's interesting, I thought, that this is impacting Jackson County because we've done stories about how the county is actually in a pretty good financial situation right now, but there's just still limits to what the county can spend on these services.
And this isn't the first time that Jackson County has closed part of the jail, right?
Correct. So this is the third time in the last decade or so. And this is really just a recurring theme at the sheriff's office. Sickler says that he doesn't see this trend of higher costs ending anytime soon. And so the only way to provide more services, to provide more beds at the jail, would be with new taxes. And that would be accomplished through a ballot measure. This was tried back in 2020. Voters really didn't like the idea back then. Over 70% voted against it. And in 2024, they did a survey that showed 43% are in favor of a law enforcement levy, so that kind of increased in popularity a little bit. Sickler says that at some point they're going to try this again, but now probably isn't the right time as sort of everyone's hurting with the economy.
It seems like it might be a tough sell as everyone's expenses are going up as well.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Justin. Jane? We're going to talk about the Bandon School District again, but you covered some updates. Tell us what's happening this week there.
Right. There's been a lot of updates on the Coastal Bandon School District. So this week, the school board started their search process for their interim superintendent. They need an interim because their current superintendent, Shauna Schmier, is on paid administrative leave while a third party is investigating complaints against her. And she's also resigned, so her last day with the district is on June 30th. So either way, the district needs an interim. The school had a presentation this week from the Oregon School Boards Association. They've started discussing salary for this position. person, maybe wanting that person to be half or three quarters time to save money rather than full time. They decided on a search timeline, qualifications they want this person to have. So their plan basically is to hire a 1-year interim and then hire a permanent superintendent after that. Their final selection is expected to be made in late July. And then their meeting this week, they also filled 2 vacant school board seats that had been vacant from resignation. So it was a busy meeting.
And give us some context for the situation there in the Vanden School District. Why are they hiring an interim and doing this search?
There's been a lot going on there. There's been some turmoil in the past, I would say, year or so. There's been a lot of complaints filed against school board members, against the superintendent. Some of them were dismissed. Some of them have been forwarded to this third-party investigator who's now investigating. Some former employees have accused the superintendent, Shauna Schmier, of creating a hostile work environment, engaging in intimidation. The teachers' union filed a separate complaint alleging retaliation and dishonest and manipulative communication. So those are some of the complaints that the investigator is currently looking into, and that report is expected pretty soon, sometime this month. There's also been a lot of teachers who have resigned. The superintendent has said that she has faced slander and abuse. The district is also waiting for a decision in an unfair labor practices complaint that was filed by the teachers union. There was a hearing with the State Employment Relations Board. There's been a lot of parental complaints and concerns and pushback. People are mad at the union. People want to just focus on the kids. So there's been a lot happening there in the past year or so.
And that all led to a recent settlement agreement, too?
Yes. So the district also recently settled with the teachers union over a grievance that they had filed. And that grievance alleged that the district had violated their collective bargaining agreement with these involuntary teacher transfers. That had been a big point of contention. So the union had alleged that the district didn't provide teachers with the opportunity to make their preferences known before they were transferred involuntarily, said the district didn't hold required meetings between the principal and the teacher before being transferred, and other things basically that they say the district violated that agreement. And so the district had previously denied that grievance. They were scheduled for an arbitration hearing later this month, but they decided to settle instead. So the district admitted that it violated the contract with the involuntary transfers and has said they won't do that again in the future. They did not reinstate the effective teachers or provide compensation for loss of pay. Those were things the union had originally requested, but they did admit that they violated the contract. There's no monetary compensation, no money exchanged there. The union president, Jen Ells, sent me a statement saying that they basically just wanted this to be done. It was never about the money. They just really wanted acknowledgement of what had happened to their teachers. Also, many of the affected teachers had quit, so it's hard to reinstate them at this point. The union also did ask for reinstatement and back pay in the pending unfair labor practices complaint, so that could still come back. And they're really just hoping to move forward now and get some new leadership. The district has not responded to my request for comment, so this doesn't really have any effect on the Employment Relations Board case or the third-party investigation, but it's interesting, and I'll be keeping an eye out for the results of those other things too.
Okay, so we'll probably be talking about that again at some point. Okay, thank you so much, Jane. And Roman, now we're doing a little something unusual. This is a story that hasn't been published on our website yet, but we can give listeners a little sneak peek. You reported on changes to Jackson County libraries. What's happening there?
Yeah, so people might have been hearing about this if they've been following the news, but the biggest change is that the Sunday hours at the Medford and Ashland libraries are going to be gone. They were the only libraries in the district with those hours, but they're going to be getting rid of them. There's also some changes to the Thursday hours. Some of the libraries were open later on Thursdays, and they've shifted that back to being open from 10 to 5. And then they've also, for most of the libraries in the district on Saturdays, they're instead going to open at 10 a.m. instead of noon. But I think, you know, the biggest change, obviously, is closing all of their libraries now on Sundays.
Yeah, that makes it a little harder sometimes to get to the library. Why is the library changing these hours?
Yeah, it's really because of the cost. It's because of budget changes for the library district. You know, most of their money comes from this district-wide tax, and that tax revenue has not been increasing enough to meet the rising expenses for the library. Everyone is paying more, including
libraries.
Yeah,
I think
libraries.
We just heard about that for the Jackson County Jail.
All of that cost. And so the district board approved a new budget last month, which includes, you know, these hour changes and other stuff. And they basically said, and from people I talked to, that looking at the data, the Sunday hours and those Thursday hours were not used as much as other times. And so that's why they decided to close those. They also said for the Sunday specifically, it's going to be, you know, cheaper to save a lot more money if they close the entire day rather than just cutting back on a few hours across the whole week. So they're going to be able to save a lot more money that way. And they hope that by making those changes now, they're going to have to avoid other cuts elsewhere. So, you know, these changes for these hours were originally made just a few years ago as part of the library district's goal to expand hours. But, you know, now clearly those budget changes means they have to go back on those and downsize a bit again.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Roman, for your reporting on that. People can find that on ijpr.org soon. That's it for the debrief this week. Thank you for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.